This programme is brought to you by UCL, London's global university.
What I want to do today is actually talk about a project which has become not just dear to my heart, it's my life work at this moment in time, which is the London Project to Cure Blindness. The aim of the project is within 5 years to introduce a cell therapy from stem cells, human embryonic stem cells, into the clinic from the initiation of the project, which was in April 2007. I can say that my phone needs turning off or throwing away. I'll give it you guys. I'll give it you. Thank you. It's no trick, don't worry. The project started in April 2007, and I can thankfully say that we're not only on time, but actually slightly ahead of timeline in trying to go into those first initial clinical trials. So, age-related macular degeneration, it's a disease of the eye, and I'm going to take you through why we think the whole approach of stem cells can be used as a therapeutic for that disease. One of the beauties of the eye, and again, this is great in terms of making sure that this therapy is safe, is the fact that we have a window which we can see into and try and at least use the information and images that we get from the back of the eye to understand not just the disease, but also what is happening when we put these cells into the eye. So as we go through the eye, and that red reflection which comes back from a camera, in fact, is just the red signal coming from the back of the eye, and it's the neural retina. That's the part of the eye which is processing the visual information. Now, amazingly, in fact, we, as in where we're trying to go and what we're trying to achieve, is in a very small area of the eye, the retina. In fact, it's only approximately about 10%. So if there's any disease around that area, the majority of people here would not in any way go to a clinician, their doctor, and say they have a visual problem. It's only when it goes into that 10% of the eye do people start to report serious, significant problems. And in fact, the picture of that back of the eye doesn't really do justice to the underlying biology because it's three layers. But one area which we need to concentrate on is an area known as the macula, and in specific terms, an area even within that called the fovea. And the reason for that is that area deals with high visual acuity. High visual acuity being how you recognize faces, how you read. And it's when the disease starts to encroach onto those structures that people will then go to their doctors and say they have a problem seeing and reading. Okay, so let's go a bit further into this. That picture doesn't do justice because actually there's three layers there. And in fact, the middle layer is the one which is most important in this disease. And it's a carpet of cells. It's an Axminster of carpets, in fact. It's a very important one in that it supports both the neural retina and also takes nutrients from the blood and supports the seeing part of the eye, which is the retina. So it has an intimate relationship with a big blood supply right at the back of the eye, which is effectively a heat sink. It's taking the heat away from the eye because, in fact, your eye and that seeing part of the eye, the neural retina, is probably the most metabolically active substance in the whole of your body. It's processing all the time visual information. So it gets rid of rubbish and it also takes nutrients from the blood. But it needs to support the neural retina. Okay. And it's that support in two forms. One is in terms of the turnover of debris. So it gets rid of rubbish and it also supports it in terms of giving it nutrients. So what happens to people when this disease starts to occur? Well, first of all, they start to report distortions in text. They have the real inability to see or read sentences. And they start to twist, turn, and also missing components. And clinically, there's a very quick way in which you can determine where in the vision the problem really is. And you can use what's called the Amsler grid. The Amsler grid is a very simple grid in which it's just lines, and you see these distortions, and you can get a very clear idea where the problem in the visual area, in the visual field is. And in fact, this is used now as a way of people screening themselves to ensure that the any treatments that are being used or the state of the actual disease and its progression can be tracked. So what you should see is actually just a set of standard lines. So in the top, you see this depression, but on the bottom, you should see standard lines. If these two are the same, it would indicate that there was some visual problem. Actually, I was just joking. You should see a standard grid and a non-standard grid. I think we got nearly a full clinical trial going there. Okay. That worried everyone, didn't it? Okay. So, actually, it's a standard grid, and what an AMD patient will report are these distortions. Okay, but what does it look like? We can take these beautiful pictures at the back of the eye in patients. We don't need magnets. We can do this with very simple cameras, simple equipment. They're called fundus pictures. And they give beautiful detail of the back of the eye. So the majority of us, hopefully for the majority of our lives, see perfectly and have a perfect retina at the back of the eye. The white spot is where all the information leaves the retina. This pigmented darker area is that macular fovea area, which, if there's any disease in that area, will affect high visual acuity. Age-related macular degeneration tends to result in this central deterioration of vision. It's called a scotoma. And in fact, this picture doesn't do justice to how bad the peripheral vision is, in fact. The peripheral vision is a lot worse than this. So what does the underlying biology look like? There's two forms. There's one form called dry, and it's associated with these deposits, these fatty deposits called drusen. And the majority of us, as we age, will have some of these deposits in the back of the eye. But as I said, it's only when those deposits start to encroach on that macula do people start to report these visual problems. The peripheral vision really doesn't take part in anything other than night vision, really. So it's only this central portion which is crucial in terms of reading, facial recognition, driving, etc. So that's the dry form. The dry form accounts for anywhere between 80 and 90% of the clinical population. And to date, and as far as I can see at least at the moment, there is no current therapies which are either on the market, coming onto the market, or are really in clinical trial which show any improvement for this clinical group. The second one is called wet, and the reason it's called wet is because you have this bleed into the neural retina. So you still have the fatty deposits, but what happens is that big blood supply at the back of the eye pushes blood through the back because those cells, that carpet of cells, is no longer able to sort of form a barrier. So blood enters the eye, which we don't want, pushes the neural seeing part of the retina away from its support, and as a consequence, starts to deteriorate and die. So, let me just show you that in terms of a cartoon, in terms of the biology. So what we're interested in is the macula and the fovea. But the problem is, we have this carpet of cells which starts to deteriorate and degenerate. If that happens, then there's no support for the photoreceptors, and the photoreceptors start to die and degenerate. So the primary cause of the disease pathology, underlying pathology, is this carpet of cells. But if that goes, then the seeing part of the eye, the neural retina, the photoreceptors deteriorate, and therefore a person goes blind. So what we envisaged was, if we can get these carpet of cells back under those photoreceptors, we should be able to stop people going blind. And it's not a neural network. The reason I went into this area back in 1998 is, if you're going to look at a cell therapy, this is a very, very complex neural network structure. This is relatively simple. It's just a single layer, a monolayer of cells. So it was my approach back at the late 90s to actually just take an idea, which is, can we not just grow these cells in this manner, which we could then surgically implant back into a clinical population? So what we're trying to do is put back the cells which have died to ensure that it keeps the neural retina intact, stops the photoreceptors from dying. And there are two already clinical procedures which prove that is possible. One of them is called macular translocation. And this is where you literally lift the whole of the seeing part of the retina off the back of the eye and twist it 30 degrees plus and put it back down on a healthy piece of RPE. So you're moving what is the normal retina away from the disease. And if it were the case that you then have got that support back, if this works, then clearly that's proof of principle, proof of concept, that potentially regenerating and putting those cells back will stop people from going blind. So this isn't a cartoon. This is actually a procedure. And I'm going to show you a bit of gore, as in this is the surgical procedure. Sorry. So here the retina is being twisted. It's been cut all the way around the rim, and it's being twisted and put back down onto a clean, healthy piece of RPE. Okay, I don't want to do it too long. That procedure takes about 3 hours. It's a huge operation and involves a further two operations. One is, because you've twisted the retina, you have to operate on the muscles and twist the eye back round. Also, because you've taken the whole retina off, you have to push it back down on the back of the eye, and you have to use what's called heavy oil. 6 weeks after the procedure, you have to remove the heavy oil. So there's three procedures, three-hour operation, and quite complex. But this is Avery, who went through that procedure. When she went through the procedure, prior to the operation, she had a bleed, as I showed you for in the wet AMD case. She couldn't read the big A. Oh, can we have the sound? Someone's turned the sound off. Can you turn it up? Sorry.
Circumstances are individual. Okay. Hence, right, it follows right, that in all...
So this is Avery, who went through this procedure and couldn't read the big A. She is now down to this line and has been there now for nearly 4+ years. And we found out in January of this year, to my amazement, I must say, that she got a driving licence back. I'm not going to be sexist at all, but actually she's blind in one eye, so she has no stereopsis whatsoever. So if you see this woman driving, be careful. Thankfully, Avery's not in the audience today. So there was one procedure. Remove the blood, twist the retina, put it down on some healthy RPE, and you're going to keep this person's vision intact. The second one, which is the one we've had the major work going on in the London project, is what's called autologous transplantation. And again, I'm going to show you a video. So this is where we're actually lasering out a piece of the patient's own RPE and placing it under the macula. So instead of twisting the whole retina and moving it to some healthy RPE, we're taking some RPE and putting it under the macula. So, sorry, some more gory operations. Okay. I'm going to take this. So, taking out some scar tissue again, and you'll see the operation will then laser out a carpet of RPE peripheral to the macula. So, a slab of RPE will be removed. So it's blinding that person's peripheral vision. We are taking that vision away. But because it's peripheral, this person would prefer to have the central vision as opposed to the peripheral. That's the neural retina, and it's been removed from the patient. Okay. Now, this is obviously what we want, the RPE, which will then be placed under the macula. I'll just run it a bit more. To give an idea of the size of the operation, this optic nerve head here is about 1.5 millimetres. So this is quite delicate, to say the least. But the procedure is a standard vitreoretinal procedure. So this is the slab of RPE being placed under the macula. And I just have to go to the BBC to tell you what happened on this one. Sorry, it's just going to load up. So the patient who was reported...
...poor vision and relied on friends and relatives to be his eyes. But thanks to pioneering surgery, his sight has been restored. The 75-year-old suffered from a condition known as macular degeneration, a disease common in the over-60s that can cause blindness. And as our medical correspondent Fergus Walsh reports, the scientists are now hoping to take the procedure a step further.
This is the sort of blurred and distorted vision that affects people with age-related macular degeneration. An operation to partially restore sight would have enormous benefits. The condition is the leading cause of blindness. And because we're living longer, the number affected will increase threefold in the next 25 years. Donald Kane used to be blind. When he reached 70, age-related macular degeneration gradually robbed him of sight. But pioneering surgery has restored three-quarters of the vision to his right eye.
Before I had the operation, I couldn't walk across the road on my own. When it went properly, my wife always had to come across with us. Now, I mean, I can stand on the pavement, count 20, 30 cars right up the road. Watch them go by and then walk across the road. Safe as hell, like you would.
This is footage of Donald's operation. He's one of only three people in Britain to have their sight restored using this technique.
He's obviously trying to look out for Avery, I think, so. Sorry, I just shouldn't have said that. Okay, so what we're looking at is yet another operation, a different technique, but to try and get those cells back under the macula. So what we have are two procedures, and this is what Donald went through at the beginning, and this is the transplant post-surgery. Here is, again, a very good technique now that we can use in ophthalmology, which gives you a slice through the retina using a technology called OCT, and we can see where the transplant lies and the neural retina sitting very comfortably over the top of it. So, that was Donald. If we look at current therapies, so for the wet disease, these drugs are actually used to stop the bleeding. They don't actually stop the disease advancing, but they do actually stop the bleeds. This is the results we're getting from the surgery, which not only stop the bleed, but actually stop the progression of the disease. So the problem is, though, it's too long an operation. 3 hours, you could never consider this as a standard clinical procedure. What we want is something more like cataract surgery. And cataract surgery is a 20-minute procedure and is effectively one of the most effective therapies in terms of its cost and benefit to the NHS. So if we could get this procedure down to 20 minutes, or to 45 at least, then we could see this as a standard clinical procedure. Equally, we don't cover the whole of the macula. We can't do that using the procedure where we use the slab of tissue. We would like to do a 6x4mm disc. We can't do that by taking and harvesting from the patient's own eye. So we need to, in some way, improve it. And the way we wanted to improve it is stem cells. If we can grow those patches outside the body and then surgically transplant them, we should be able to get the whole procedure down to effectively what would be an outpatient procedure. So, for a number of years, we've looked at adult tissue, fetal tissue, and what I'm going to talk about today is the results using human embryonic stem cells. So human embryonic stem cells, in fact, we've only used three lines. That's all we've used for this project. It's a donated blastocyst, which was given as part of IVF therapy. And in fact, it's a small group of cells known as the inner cell mass. From those massive cells, every single cell in our body develops. So that's why scientists, stem cell scientists, are so interested in these cells. They already have the potential to turn into whatever cell type you would want. The only one they don't turn into is the placenta. Okay. So here is a micrograph, and here are the cells, and on a pinhead, this is all we're taking for this therapy. Okay. And in fact, that patch is just 40,000 cells. This is not a huge number of cells. In fact, in this, you're looking at nearly 40,000 patients could be treated. So you don't need a huge factory for this type of procedure. You're not using millions of cells. It's just a single monolayer. So we have a group over here, in fact, who've spent most of their academic scientific career working out how do you actually turn a human embryonic stem cell into an eye cell. And we now know quite well nearly all the various elements which will turn them into the eye cell we want, which is that eye cell at the back of the eye, those pigmented cells, they're black, called retinal pigment epithelium. So we know what the biology of that development is. And in fact, this is what we can grow in the laboratory already. So this is taken from a 17-year-old's eye, and this is what we can grow from the human embryonic stem cells in terms of carpets. So sadly, this is what gets me out of bed, is this pattern of blackness. In fact, this whole region will remain pigmented. These start to lose their pigmentation in the dish. So again, these cells are obviously almost super RPE and look very much like embryonic type RPE, which is exactly the type of cell we want. So we can grow the cells. We can grow them into these monolayers and carpets. But do they actually do what we want them to do, and are they actually RPE? And the answer is, this is a micrograph. So this is an electron microscope picture taken through those cells. And you can see the pigmentation. And what this indicates to us in terms of the way it forms is it's orientated in the right way. These cells are very much what we call polarized. They have to be in a certain orientation. And this pigmentation and the fact that they have these little fingers, which are called microvilli, which allow them to get rid of the rubbish. This is a human outer segment. So those pieces of neural retina, which we took from the patients where we were transplanting the RPE, were placed onto these cells. So even in a dish, we can recreate what we would expect these cells to do in the eye to make sure that these cells are actually doing what we would hope they would do when we put them back into an eye. And again, we've got guys over here who are molecular biologists and have gone through a whole battery of what we would expect to see these cells do. And in fact, one element which is crucial for RPE is RPE65, which is a component involved in the whole phototransduction, so the way in which the cells process vision. And in fact, what was seen as the gold standard cell up until the use of human embryonic stem cells, which was this ARP19 cell, did not express RP65. So again, to our amazement, these cells really do look like the cell we want to put back into a patient. And this just shows you that we can recreate almost a retina in a dish where we can put the human retina on and look at this whole process of phagocytosis and support of a neural retina. Okay, there is one big problem. Not just one, maybe there's two. One of the big problems is they normally sit on a membrane at the back of the eye called Bruch's membrane. And Bruch's membrane in the aged eye does not sustain just squirting cells in and letting them sit down on them. It just doesn't do it. So we have a second problem we had to overcome. The issue here is in aging, the whole sort of stickiness of that membrane doesn't support the RPE. Equally, as I already said, we want to put the cells in a carpet already, in a mature state, and polarized, facing the right way. And also, we decided, well, we would need to put them on something surgically for a surgeon to put them into the eye. So we've also gone through a whole manufacturing of a patch, an artificial patch, in which we can grow these cells on. So, when we've manufactured it and grown it, we can actually see whether these cells form this nice little, what's called cobblestone. That they look nice, and we went through a whole engineering process to pick what was a very thin, it's as thin as cling film, but it was very, very strong so that the surgeon could manipulate it in the eye. So, we have cells. We can grow them as carpets, and we can put them on a patch. Can we get any evidence anywhere in an animal that this might work? And the answer is yes, in what is known grandly as the Royal College of Surgeons rat, which suffers from a problem right at the back of the eye in that those support cells don't support, they don't get rid of the debris at the back of the eye, and the animals subsequently go blind. So if you put, so these animals are grown with a normal retina, but the RPE fail and they subsequently go blind. So this is where we've put these human cells into these rats, and we need to test their vision. Sadly, we can't get them to read the times, and we can't get them to do the eye chart. We tried, they're just not bothered. So what you have to do is put them into this big arena, and there's this grating which we can rotate. And this grating effectively is the big A right down to the small e. So the finer the grating, the better the vision. And if the animal tracks it, that's an indication it can see. Now, this is not learnt. It's a normal response. In children, you would see this up until the age of about 3 as well. So let me show you what happens. So this is a normal sighted Royal College of Surgeons rat. Okay? So you see it's just following the grating. Yep, you believe me. Good. This is a blind Royal College of Surgeons rat. Not a good story on the grating, obviously. Can't see it. And that's the lowest grating we go. And this is a Royal College of Surgeons rat with human cells in it, human RPE cells. There you go. Okay. This guy went for nearly 2 years. And then we gave him a good wake. It was a good wake. Okay, so you can see here that actually this animal tracks. It should be blind, it should be like this animal, but actually, as long as it's got functional RPE in that eye, the animal does not go blind. So we've gone through to animal models. Problem is there, that's a very small animal. That's not the procedure we would use in a patient. So we've now gone to a large patient, and the large patient is a pig. And the pig eye is approximately the same size as a human eye. And in fact, Again, what we had to set up at Northwick Park was a whole operating theatre with all the equipment we would do on a patient, which we would do on a large animal. And now you've seen the procedure as it was done in a patient where we took a slab from the side. This is what we envisage we would do as the therapeutic. So just taking the vitreous out, which is the fluid at the back of the eye, and then putting an injection of fluid into the neural retina to push it away from the back of the eye. You need to take the fluid out of the back of the eye so you can detach the neural retina. And you'll see this in a minute. So this is the neural retina. A small cut is going to be made into the neural retina, and there's the disc of cells being placed under, between the neural retina and the back of the eye. And this whole procedure took 40 minutes. Okay. And in fact, at Moorfields, nearly 70% of procedures like this are done on awake patients, believe it or not. So now we really are down to a possible out-clinic procedure which could be done as a standard clinical procedure. So we've put this into the large animal. We've put RPE back. What we want to make sure is it stops those photoreceptors from degenerating. Here's the patch. Here's half the patch covered with some RPE. You can see the pigmentation and a clear area. This is an autofluorescence image, which if the cells autofluoresce, it means they're actually getting rid of debris. So they're functional. And this is the anatomy. So here's our patch, this thin layer here. Here's the pigmented cells on that patch. And here is almost a full complement of photoreceptors. Here's the patch, no pigmented cells on it, no photoreceptors. This layer of cells corresponds to this layer of cells. So in fact, what we've shown now in the large animal, and we've trialled the procedure as you would do it in a patient, is that as long as you've got RPE on your patch, you will stop those photoreceptors from degenerating. So what we propose within the timeline of the project is to go into a phase one, phase two clinical trial of about 10 patients, which will look at two clinical populations in that initial study so we can accelerate it. And that will be in retinal tears. So this is where literally a person the week before had perfect vision, and then the following week they've had a tear in the RPE and they've got bare Bruch's membrane. So we will put the patch of cells in those patients straight away. It's quite rare, but it's about 5 patients a year. The other one is Lucentis is used for wet. So again, you have people coming in where they've had a bleed in the eye and they're given injections of Lucentis to stop the bleeds. There are about 20 patients seen every week at Moorfields who have Lucentis injections. 2 of those patients, those injections won't work. So the idea would be then those patients in which it doesn't work enter this trial where we put the RPE back. It would be their only chance of keeping their vision. So that's the phase one, phase two clinical trial which we want to go into. Okay, but the targets are more. The major target we're wanting to approach is dry AMD, because that is the clinical population for which there is absolutely no current therapy. Equally, inherited macular dystrophy, because that is associated in a younger population. And also choroideremia, and as I said, the Lucentis issue in terms of wet macular degeneration. So that's where we hope to expand these trials as well. But this whole area is changing at a phenomenal rate. And just in 2006, Yamanaka in Japan was able to turn effectively a skin cell on a mouse into a stem cell. So you could actually take someone's own skin. Then what was reported was you could do exactly the same with human cells. So you could take someone's skin, turn it into a stem cell, and then could we turn that into an eye cell, for example? And that's exactly where we've gone as well. So part of the project is also looking at turning these what are called inducible pluripotent stem cells, so stem cells made from a person themselves, from their own skin, for example, into a stem cell and then into an eye cell. And I can report, this hasn't been published at all, this is very new, that we have looked at these inducible pluripotent stem cells and we can turn them into RPE. So this is a potential therapy. Now, to turn your skin into a stem cell, however, the technology involves using genetic modifications. That cannot be used in the clinic in its present form, so the technology has to advance in some way of doing it chemically by using factors. And in fact, just over the last 2 months, a number of papers have started to report that you don't need to manipulate four genes. You can actually use some chemical methods to do it instead. If that then becomes true, this whole area of using a person's own cell as the source of a stem cell may actually come to fruition, potentially towards clinics. The only proviso I would have is, if there is a genetic fault, will that be carried into the new stem cell? And we don't know yet. We are looking at that ourselves. So, the future again, we hope we can replace the RPE, and that will serve a huge unmet clinical need both in AMD and in also inherited macular dystrophies. We may be able to, dependent on how late stage the disease is, look at replacing the photoreceptors. But there, the big issue is that is a neural network. Those cells are extremely specialised and they have to connect into that network. That's a very tall order, but we are looking at that as well. One which we really do want to go into, and I think is almost as addressable as the RPE, is potentially looking at vascular problems in diabetic retinopathy. So the biggest cause of blindness in the working population between the ages of 30 and 50, and that age is coming down, is diabetic retinopathy. And we have some evidence to suggest we may be able to reconstruct the vasculature in that clinical population. And then glaucoma. Glaucoma, I think, may be a very difficult problem in terms of cell replacement. It's not that we may not be able to make ganglion cells, but these ganglion cells have to connect to the brain, which is A, some distance away from the eye, and B, there's a number of centres in the brain that connection needs to be made. What you could envisage, however, is using cells as a delivery mechanism of some type of a chemical factor which will stop those cells from dying. That may be a possibility. So, finally, the people who are involved in this project, some of them are here today, from the Institute of Ophthalmology. Anthony's here, and Amanda's here. Matt's just started with us on a different project, funded by the Fight for Sight. The collaboration, the project also involves Peter Andrews and Harry Moore at the Centre for Stem Cell Biology in Sheffield. My co-conspirator in this whole project being Lyndon de Cruz at Moorfields Eye Hospital, and excellent help from Karen Cheetham at UCL Business. And finally, in terms of the IPS, this is a collaboration with UC Santa Barbara in the United States. The support, we had an anonymous donation. University College London has been a major funder in this whole project, and Mostra, who's here, Nikki Jenkins, who's actually been involved in just promotion in terms of the website which was built, which is absolutely phenomenal. And here's the website address for anyone who would like any further information. The Macular Disease Society, who at a time when we were needing some small funds, but funds which were crucial to us for our survival, were very supportive, both financially and in their verbal support. Michael Cross, who's a great supporter of UCL. And then just recently, we've had a major donation from the Lindsay Foundation. Thank you very much.
To find out more about UCL, please visit us at itunes.ucl.ac.uk.